Welcome to the NCO Journal podcast, where we explore NCO professional development. This is a podcast series where we discuss published articles with authors and provide a forum for the open exchange of ideas, information, and solutions. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Owen Thebs, NCO Journal's senior editor. With us is the managing editor, Chago Zapata, and the NCOIC Sergeant First Class, Brandon Cox. Today, we discuss the article, Battlefield Now, Emerging Threats and Technologies in Modern Warfare, with authors retired Command Sergeant Major Dr. Rob Nelson and Sergeant Major Daniel Sheely. Before we kick things off, could you please tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Good morning, NCO Journal team. My name is Dr. Robert Nelson. First, I want to say thank you for having us on this morning. It's always fun to talk about stuff that we have written. I had a 30-year career in the Army with a medical background. I retired about 2.5 years ago and came back to work for the non-commissioned officer course, where I'm currently a department chair in the Department of Army Operations. So a lot of this stuff that we've kind of written about in this article are things that we're talking about all the time. We're researching and we're trying to find out information on. So with that, though, let me turn it over to my battle buddy, Sergeant Major Sheely.
Hi, good morning, team. My name's Sergeant Major Sheely. I'm an instructor here at the Non-Commissioned Officer Academy Sergeant's Major course. I'm in Department of Army Operations. This is my second year as an instructor here. I have a 27-year career as infantry, and I'm happy to be here this morning. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, I'll say another thing, too, about Sergeant Major Sheely. A lot of the stuff that's written about, he's seen a fair amount of it in real life. So he's got some really good experiences to share. We actually relied on him a lot for this article. So I'm interested to hear what questions you guys have.
Could you please give us a brief overview of your article?
Yeah, so this article, I think it's appropriately titled Battlefield Now. It's about emerging technologies that we're seeing implemented in the world today that are going to affect the way that we fight wars. Some of it is a little bit futuristic when you start looking at genetic engineering and exoskeletons and stuff like that, but it's out there and there are things that we are looking at. So we wrote this article that we covered probably the top 20 or so different threats that we think are being used right now by our adversaries or that we are trying to develop. So the NCOs can start thinking about that stuff a little bit early, and maybe they could, you know, maybe something we've written in the article sparks a little bit of interest and they can do a little bit more research on it. And they can become a little bit more prepared and have a little bit more of an informed opinion and maybe have a little bit better training for their soldiers. So that's really what it was about.
Based on what you just said to Sergeant Major, made me think of something that was a big innovation that it was initially considered yeah, not important, was rifling. I know it's a technological innovation that changed that battlefield back in the day, back in the probably the late 1800s, and it was a game changer. And there's things happening today now that you could say are game changers as well. And I would say probably, you know, with AI and drones and the things that are happening that we're seeing in the world right now, especially with what's happening in Iran, I would say that, you know, that technology are things that are still being explored. So let's talk about drones. Why did you bring that as part of the discussion talking about drones? I know it's a big part of what's happening in the world, especially with Ukraine and Iran. But what can you tell us about drones?
Well, where to begin? The current operational environment, it's definitely changed from what we were accustomed to from a few years ago with the COIN mission or the GWAT mission, for example. With the advances in technology, it is relatively cheap to implement the smaller versions of drones, whether they're loitering munitions or one-way drones, and they can be mass-produced at a decentralized manner, like we're seeing right now, where entities that traditionally didn't have like an air force, they can now operate freely in the air domain.
You're talking more in the strategic level. How does this apply for NCOs? How does this significant for NCOs? Not just at the senior level, but also today at the young you know, at the team level, for instance?
Sure. Great example. Great question. It kind of gets back to doing the basics, like blocking and tackling football. If we equate the drone to the GWAT error, the IED, we had a lot of individual crew and small unit drills that could be implemented to kind of counter their effectiveness. The prime example, fives and 25s, constantly scanning, utilizing buddy techniques, team level maneuvering, for example, can significantly reduce the effectiveness of a drone strike.
Well, talk about what we were talking about before we started on this with the dispersion, the individual discipline that can reduce like the detectability on the battlefield.
Yes, absolutely. Individual responsibility. For example, individual camouflaging techniques, whether you're in an offensive or defensive position, let's say if you're in a fighting position, how well is your overhead cover? Are you utilizing camouflage? Getting back to a term we used to say is field craft. Are soldiers proficient in doing the individual responsibilities and counteraction to manage their effectiveness? Let's say if you're doing, for example, like a platoon movement to contact, what's your dispersion rates? Are you within 25 meters for the whole formation? Are you spread out going over open terrain? Are you utilizing concealment and cover? Are you doing one of the movement techniques, whether it's travel overwatch, or bounding? Getting back to the basics of maneuvering and small unit level tactics can greatly reduce the effectiveness of drones.
Yeah, nice.
Let's move on from drones. I think that's a conversation that, I mean, having seen some of the things that are happening in that happened in Ukraine over the past few years, and then the way that I was saying that let's move on from it, but let's stick with it a little bit longer because, again, seeing what Ukraine was doing and the Russians were doing, dropping, you know, using drones to drop, you know, bombs and tanks, and now the way the Iranians are using them to affect shipping in the Straits of Hormuz and then flying under the radar, attacking bases, and doing all the things that they're doing. What other considerations, maybe you, Dr. Nelson, would you say that NCOs should consider when it comes to drones?
Well, I would say the best thing the NCOs can think about when it comes to drones is just kind of stay current on what's out there. The Army actually has a manual on drones, and it updates thus far about every other year because there's been so much change in the field. But they need to understand that it's a real part of the battlefield. It's something that they will encounter. If you look at a LESCO type environment, potentially against a near peer or sustained operations, we might be experiencing some sort of level of trench warfare in the skies with drones, where each side is, you know, fighting for inches to try to gain the, you know, advantage on the opposing force through a method called top attack, where you essentially get over the person, tank, individual, or whatever, and attack straight down, because that's usually a weak point. Another thing I would say about drones, and this is kind of hard to conceptualize, but the technology is changing so fast that it's really hard to predict what's coming. You know, Yogi Berra once said it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. And I definitely have to agree with him. Right now, when this article was written, it was about 9 months ago. Since then, there have been updates in tactics and procedures. Now we're talking about being able to 3D print micro drones that can act as surveillance sensors. So I guess that might be the other thing the NCOs can think about. They might not even be able to see the drones, and they need to operate under the concept that they're constantly being observed. They're constantly being sensed, and the enemy is constantly trying to figure out where they're at so they can attack and kill them. Then another thing maybe to add to that is, you know, this isn't limited to one side. You know, these are things that, you know, we're exploring as well. It's not just, you know, the bad guys trying to find new ways to use drones. If you look at what's happened in Ukraine and how we've helped them and some of the things that we might be doing in some of our future wars, you'll see it's definitely not a one-sided discussion. Not 100% sure if I answered your question, but I talked for a good 2 or 3 minutes like any good sergeant major should do. So what else you got?
No, I think you answered the question very well. I thought that ultimately, I think when it comes to drones or any of this technology, and Sergeant Major Sheely, you said it yourself too, I think it all comes back to the basics. You know, practicing the basics is always important, because at some point, you know, technology might be denied because of other technology, like, you know, EMPs. I know that that's another piece of technology or a bit of technology that's been out there for a while, discussed, and you see it in movies and all kinds of things. And that would be a denial of technology, which means that you have to go back to the basics, land nav, just using your two Cadillacs to get around as well. You know, that's what we called it back in the day. Sometimes you just got to use your two Cadillacs to get to where you need to go. But moving on here, nuclear weapons. I know that that's something that was discussed in your article. I don't know that there's too much discussion there, unless you have some points you'd like to make about it. But I think, you know, nuclear weapons is something that I guess it all comes back to NCOs being informed. So what can you tell us about that subject?
Sure. It's on every unit's training schedule, but some form of CBRN training. And it's something we need to readdress each and every year, make sure that stays relevant and on units' medals. However, it starts with the individual proficiency. How long does it take to put on your MOP gear, to don the protective mask, to decontaminate, let's say, your equipment or your vehicle that you're utilizing? And then it has to be done at scale, and then also repeatedly, so it becomes second nature or just like any other battle drill at the individual level.
Right. I think it's the thing, because, you know, in COIN and for the last 20 years, nuclear hasn't been a threat. NBC or CBRN hasn't been a threat. So it's something that we definitely have to learn up, you know, train ourselves on, make sure we're proficient, and then start making sure our soldiers are trained, because we are likely to encounter it in a less skilled environment. One of the things, if you look at some open source information that's on the Army G2's page, they have a couple of different manuals they've produced on how some of our adversaries fight. And one of the things that Russia thinks that they can do, because we tend to have an operational overmatch for them, is they think they can counter that with the use of tactical nuclear weapons. So we're not talking like the, you know, the 300 megaton bombs that can destroy cities, but we're talking about one megaton bombs that a soldier might individually carry. If you look back in our history, we had something in the 50s called the Davy Crockett, which was a shoulder fired nuclear weapon that a squad would carry around. A little bit scary if you think about it, but, you know, we could be facing something like that in the future. So understand that it's a real threat, get smart on it, and train your soldiers on it is the best thing I think we can do.
Anything to add, gentlemen?
No, not to news.
They're bad.
you talked about hypersonic aircraft, and the air warfighting domain. What does that have to do with NCOs and the more tactical level NCOs?
Knowing your defensive posture, for example, have to get into the mindset of, yes, you might be in a CONUS location or even OCONUS. What type of hardening has the unit done? For example, you know, bomb shelters, indirect fire shelters. What about alert systems? Are those systems in place? And then are they continuously rehearsed? It might be one thing to have a plan in case an installation get hit by a hypersonic weapon, but then also, have you rehearsed it? Do you know where the CCP locations are at? Is there a PACE plan for communication, for example, so you can have emergency medical responders be able to come? It's great to have a plan, but all boils down to how proficient you are at executing said plan.
Yeah, and those are really scary, too, when you think about how fast either a hypersonic missile or aircraft actually is. John Antal wrote a book called 7 Seconds to Die, where he's analyzing, I'm going to mess up the way of saying, the Nagorno-Karabakh War.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I'm saying that right. But anyway, the whole point was, and he was talking about loitering munitions. They were using the Harab drone. It was a loitering munition that Israelis had. And it, essentially, once you heard it coming, you had about 7 seconds to take cover or it would kill you. Hypersonics are even worse than that. You might not even hear it coming. So, you know, Sergeant Major Seeley's got a great point in prepping ahead of time and making sure that your facilities are hardened and protected against an attack as best possible.
Yeah, by the time you hear it, it's already passed, right? Mm-hmm. That quick. You talked earlier about loitering munitions. Can you tell us what that is? And I think that they're using that, or Iran is using that nowadays, correct, in the war. Can you talk about
yeah.
that?
I won't comment too much on what Iran's using or isn't, but a loitering munition is essentially a torpedo in the sky that can fly around until it identifies a target, and then it can take out that target. The interesting thing about them is most of them have three ways that they can be used. You can have a human in the loop, which means the loitering munition will identify a target, it'll send it back to a control center, and a human has to push the button that says engage and kill. You can have a human on the loop where it does the same thing, except the human's got to push the don't kill button. And then it's got a fully autonomous mode where it can identify the target and take it out without even asking. So, you know, those things are kind of scary, but they're also kind of effective because they can hover over a battlefield or a certain area for 4 to 6 hours, 8 hours, depending on how long they're designed and what their capabilities are. But they're essentially in the sky. You almost can't see them. And if you're not following very good field craft and you reveal your position, it could take you out before you even knew it was coming. Anything to add to that, Dan?
Some actual techniques that are being utilized specifically with loitering munitions, they actually have them laying on the ground and wait for a particular, let's say, adversary's convoy to roll through. For a convoy to roll through, and then they power up and execute a relatively easy direct hit or kill on a vehicle, which extends the battery life, especially in colder climates. Batteries, we all know, don't last as long, but if you have that loitering munition pretty much in a standby mode on the ground, it can detect the same way, and then you can prolong battery life for that particular system.
Ah, good point.
You talked about ethics of using some of this technology. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. Ethics in war is always a hot discussion. And it really depends on your ethical lens that you're looking through. A lot of people are, their perspective is we should never let a machine decide or give it the power to kill without, you know, consulting a human first, just because machines make mistakes and they could potentially take out, you know, a hospital or a school or something, you know, that's not intended to do, or a human might stop that. I might argue, I would maybe equate this to the self-driving cars that are coming out now. They're really safe. They're safer than humans driving. But inevitably, one's going to go wacko and it's going to, you know, kill a family or something like that. And everyone's going to be up in arms about how dangerous the self-driving cars are. But in reality, they make far fewer mistakes and are much safer than human beings. I think you could almost make the same argument, the same ethical argument, for autonomous weapon systems. You know, if they're done right, the chances of collateral damage, you're going to go down significantly compared to what a human would do. If you look at every war that we've had in history, there's always been examples of humans making mistakes and killing friendlies or destroying a position that shouldn't be destroyed or something along those lines. So I think, you know, autonomous selection of targets and engaging is probably a good way to go, but not everyone's comfortable with it. No one wants to hand things over to the machines. And I think we've made probably 7 or 8 good movies about how this goes wrong. You know, you've probably seen it from the 1980s on. And it's definitely a discussion that I think needs to happen. And it really depends on your ethical lens. I told you what mine was, but there are people that are going to be the complete opposite of that. You got anything to add to that, Dan?
Sure. How does this kind of affect NCOs or like the small unit level, whereas there could be vignette scenario-based training. A few years ago, we used to utilize the engagement skill trainer where it had scenarios, shoot or don't shoot, for example. I know a lot of civilian law enforcement utilize that technology and training. And also knowing and understanding the rules of engagement down to the individual level, especially during the COIN operations, it was vital that you knew and understood effective or legal engagement requirements, depending on the certain threat that was presented. And we can roll that up and package it in training. So at the individual level on up, it's understood across the entire formation.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, what I was talking about was more of a theoretical strategy type concept or discussion. Really, you know, NCOs aren't going to decide if a weapon is in an automatic mode or a human on the loop or a human in the loop mode. That's going to be decided by hire. We just need to understand sort of what we can do about it, right? And to make sure we're trained for it.
I think that brings up a point from a previous article that you wrote, Dr. Nelson, where the understated art of knowing when to SDFU back in the day. I think it was about 3-4 years ago. You talked about, you know, speaking up, and I think that the you know, it's important that NCOs speak up, and if the commander is going to make a decision, that you make your voice heard and provide input. You know, as NCOs, I think that's the job. You know, it's also to advise the commander, you know, the best way you can with the information you have to hopefully he or she makes a decision that's like you said, ethical, but, you know, also informed with your input, as, you know, with NCO's input as well.
So. Great point. You know, and I think that's important too. And I hope any commander, any senior level NCO that might be listening or watching this understands that when you get feedback from the formation, disagreement doesn't equal disrespect. You know, if there's a certain aspect of the ROE that's in place that a lot of soldiers are disagreeing with or they don't like, you need to listen to that, understand what it is. At the end of the day, you know, we're the Army and we're going to follow the rule, or we're going to do what we're told. We're going to execute the mission. But sometimes if one of these ethical lines are crossed, it might cause a problem for some soldiers. So I think it's important to listen, understand that they're not challenging you. They're just wanting some clarification. At the end of the day, 99.99999% are going to do the right thing and follow the rules of engagement and do as they're told. So thank you. That was a great point.
Moving on, let's talk about adaptive camouflage. I know that was one of the discussion points. That seems, I mean, I think in the terms that you were talked about during the in the article, it had more to do with plates that were in vehicles and that kind of thing. Was there also maybe I'm forgetting, but was there also a part where you talked about, you know, how that might affect, you know, the soldier on the ground?
Well, I probably should have started this entire discussion with, we're not experts on any of this stuff. We've read up on some things that are out there and we have some ideas, but the concept of adaptive camouflage is something similar to like the Predator, if you've seen that, mm-hmm. where we're using some sort of monitors or cameras or some sort of adaptive painting scheme that changes with the camouflage pattern that they're in to make it more difficult to detect. I don't know, or at least I haven't seen anything where we have that for the soldier level, but I'm not saying it's not there because, like I said, I'm not an expert. You know anything about that, Dan?
Yes. Getting back to the basics, a simple tool units can implement and NCOs can execute at the small, even individual team or squad level is camouflaging vehicles when they're in the motor pool. How proficient are you to setting it up? And then is it rehearsed? I know I keep kind of referring back to that, but that's kind of the realm of the NCO, especially at the junior level. Affording time on the calendar, for example, for individual team or squad level training is just as vital. You have to have the plan. You have to have to be able to execute it. And there's a lot of techniques and innovations we can do at the small unit level For example, when you're in a patrol base, why not have that camel netting blanket, for example, that obscures your position, reduces your heat signature, to include even thermal blankets? If you know your adversary has thermal imagery technology, what can you do to mask it, either active or passive measures individuals can take up to organizational level can also take to mitigate the risk or mitigate the effects of your adversary sensors?
So that's a great point. If you don't actually have adaptive camouflage for yourself or your unit, you can adapt the camouflage you have to hopefully reduce your detectability in an environment. So that's an excellent point, Dan.
So what are some ways that, like on a small team or squad level, let's say they're doing a patrol somewhere and they're trying to camouflage their position, what do you think are some things that younger soldiers could try to think outside of the box to figure out new ways to camouflage themselves?
I'll take a swing at this one, if you don't mind. I think it all starts with looking at the type of environment you're in. Is it day or night? What type of vegetation is out there? For example, if they're laying in wait for an ambush, are they in an area that has a lot of dry leaves or thickets, for example, small brush that cracks and breaks? So every time you're shifting around in position, you're actually giving yourself away because it's loud. Masking into the terrain, the natural terrain features. The National Training Center, Geronimo, is very proficient at masking, let's say, battalion size CPs within natural terrain features. The subject is out there. There are materials for junior levels that they can have access and research and be able to implement at the individual level. Call, for example, has quite a few products about that, hard lessons learned, so we don't have to continuously try to reinvent the wheel, but also make the same mistakes.
Yeah, I think the key point there is just getting it incorporated into the training plan to where you're practicing it and you're using it. And, you know, as the OE changes and you've practiced something and you've learned about it quite a bit, hopefully you can adapt to that different OE and, you know, find a way to make yourself a little more invisible.
So. Yeah, with technology, as it progresses, just like you said, Dr. Nelson, that it, what we have today, tomorrow will be completely different than what we have today. So we have to kind of be able to prepare and adapt, I would say. But moving on here, there's the next two sections you guys talked about, the authors talked about, exoskeletons, genetic engineering, cyborgs, and then another section about on human bioenhancements. Let's talk about those two things combined. I mean, it has to do with, okay, a lot of this, it almost seems like science fiction-y, you know, like you've seen it in movies all the way from the 80s up until now. They're making movies about enhanced humans, and there's always the enhanced soldier. And I know that there's probably things that are happening out there, but what can you tell us, and what does this mean for NCOs?
Well, yeah. So a lot of this is kind of, I don't want to say it's science fiction driven, but a lot of our ideas on the way we fight do come from science fiction, really. Exoskeletons, just as an example, you can Google that. You'll find plenty of YouTube videos. We're working on exoskeletons for soldiers or for people. The thing that we're running into right now is the batteries are too large to make them effective, but as technology increases, they might get smaller. It might become something you'll see at a more tactical level. Bioengineering, bioenhancements, stuff like that. There's some concepts out there. I can't speak intelligently to anything that we're currently doing, but I will say on the medical side, we've definitely found ways to bioengineer replacement body parts, like an ear, for example. If your ear got blown off, we have the ability to grow you a new ear and put it on based on cells in your body. So, you know, that stuff's kind of out there. For NCOs, I would say the only thing in regards to this kind of science fiction sort of technology is just to keep an open mind and understand that there are things that they're going to encounter in their careers in the next 20 years that we won't even have thought of when we were serving. Look back at the idea of, you know, a cell phone. It was science fiction and, you know, Star Trek when they were pushing a button and talking to each other. And now literally I can communicate with anybody anywhere in the world with a picture unless the internet goes out. You know, in real time. And that was absolutely science fiction not that long ago. So I guess just keep an open mind, read as much as you can. And if something's out there, try to adapt as best you can to it.
A lot of these things are still being developed. But moving on here, let's talk about deepfakes and additive manufacturing. I know that deepfakes is something that's been used now for more. I mean, ever since, I know there's something that came out with the Russians deepfake something that the Ukrainians, Ukrainian president surrendered or something like that. There's things that are being used out there by other states and in different ways. What can you tell us about that and how it applies to NCOs?
Huge threat. Deepfakes, I mean, they've actually been around for some time. Peter Singer wrote a book called Like War. I think it was in 2011, 2012, where he discusses some of these things that we're dealing with, you know, as a country. It's a complicated, hard problem with social media and the fact that anybody can put anything on the internet, and the AI has gotten so good that we can essentially just tell it what it wants to make and it will create a video of the president of a country surrendering and have it believable and look real. It's a scary thing, especially in America, where we don't necessarily vet all of our news that comes through social media. A lot of it, I would say, is absolutely fake. It's just meant to sow disinformation. And our adversaries, at least Russia, is very, very good at it. They actually invented the word disinformation and made it sound like a French word so that it didn't even sound like it was a Russian word. They're very into it. And in fact, they don't even care what we believe as long as we distrust our government. So when you start talking about disinformation, you're fighting a war at a cognitive level across the population where you're trying to get that population to not support the war effort. And that's something that's hard to combat and it's real. So for NCOs, the best thing you can do is start teaching your soldiers a little bit about how to determine if something is real, how to triangulate information and find it on different sources, looking at opposing views. You know, you don't just watch everything on CNN. You don't just watch everything on Fox News. You know, maybe you look at both of them and then maybe see what's on Al Jazeera and then maybe see what's on the internet. And that way you can come up with some informed decisions on what's happening out there, compared to, you know, some country putting a spin on something or completely fabricating something that never happened. What was the other part you said? So that was the deep fakes and, the additive.
Yeah, additive manufacturing.
Yeah, that's essentially just 3D printing. I mean, we're working on this right now. We're working on ways to like 3D print parts for our vehicles in the field if something breaks so you don't have to wait as long for repairs. I mentioned earlier about 3D printing micro drones. It's one of those new technologies that we're trying to implement at as many levels as we can. I would suspect NCOs will see this in the future. If I were making a prediction, I would say it'd be the MOS in a couple of years, where we have people that are specialized in this, and we have specialized machines where we can 3D print things that are made out of metal, that are complex parts, or that even work at the micro level, where we could create some small drones or something like that, and implement them in real time. I don't think that's far-fetched. So as far as NCOs, As that technology becomes available, embrace it because it's the future.
That actually reminds me, at my last unit, I did get to see a lot of that happening. One of the units around us was doing a lot of experimenting with 3D printing, and actually their commander tasked a couple of NCOs when he found out one was into 3D printing, one was into soldering and electronics, and basically just told them, hey, figure something out and come back to me. And they made a really cool RC car with a claymore mounted to it. And it had like a tube to drop smoke grenades on the back of it. But the unit actually invested in 3D printers and was encouraging all of their soldiers to just innovate and just come up with whatever they could.
And think about that. You have a Claymore that you can drive into the enemy's territory. You don't even need to crawl forward. Great, great innovation. Great example of how NCOs can drive change through some of this stuff. That's awesome.
Let's get back to, you were talking about deepfakes. I think that's very tied very closely to social media and using social media as a weapon. Right now, just like you mentioned it before, everybody, it used to be science fiction, that cell phone, and back in, Back to the Future, maybe they might've had something similar, but cell phones were, you know, science fiction back in the day. Now it's a reality that everybody carries in their pocket, including soldiers when you're deployed. So, and social media is a big part of that, because that's how information gets around. That's how the enemy communicates as well. You know, so what can you tell us about that?
It's a huge danger. I think that goes back to the discipline and standards where you're enforcing things, even the small things at the unit level. Something as small as taking the cell phone to the field is bad. If soldiers do that and NCOs see it, they need to address it, because that's something that when you deploy, if you go into a theater with a near peer, that could cost your unit everyone's lives. There are great examples of this happening when Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine, and some of the tactics they used. If no one's familiar with it, I'd encourage you to read about it. It's a really interesting case study. But essentially what they were doing is they were triangulating off the soldier's cell phone posts so they could zero in their artillery, and they would destroy units that way. One commander was so brazen that he got a hold of one of the Ukrainian units' alert rosters, called a soldier's mother, said the soldier was in the hospital, and he could talk on his cell phone if she called him. She, of course, freaks out, calls her son, who's in the field, who answers his phone and then gives away a signal, and then they mortar their position. And then they have the audacity to send them text messages to all the phones saying, hey, how do you like that artillery? So it's something, it's a very small thing that can cause huge problems. Everyone likes to do the selfies and show the cool things they're doing, but that's absolutely not the thing to do in war. And I think that completely relates back to discipline, which completely relates to things NCOs should be doing and enforcing. Anything I missed with that?
No, I think Dr. Nelson, you're spot on with that individual responsibility, also making soldiers aware that their presence in, let's say, the cyber domain or, you know, social media could have grave consequences for the entire unit and even the mission, where it can affect our ability to be an expeditionary force, where that host nation, we lose support of their population along with ours.
Right. And, you know, it's basic OPSEC too. You know, you get these briefings every year where you talk about things you shouldn't post on social media, but it's deeper than that. In war, you shouldn't even have it with you. You shouldn't even have the ability. Nothing will come good of it.
I think you make an excellent point, Dr. Nelson. I think the deepfakes and those threats are like the most threatening for our Army. And I think, you know, just now with all the, basically everybody's tied to their phone, you know, and it's hard to get soldiers off of them. And when you go to the field and stuff like that, it's hard to keep them from them. But, you know, being a public affairs NCO, one of our biggest things is to control that mis and disinformation like you were talking about. And I think that the deep faking online is a massive threat. I think most soldiers don't even know. You know, they're too focused on, hey, we got to put this camouflage up, but they don't even realize that the signal in their pocket is going off, sending out their signal. So I think that's very important for NCOs to know. And that kind of gives the why, right? So when an NCO is like, hey, we got to put our cell phones in this box because we're going to the, you know, the CP site or whatever, this is why. So it kind of helps give them something to tell their soldiers, right? So I think that's very important. Thank you.
And it's got to be one of those things too. If you remember in the old days, we had the motto of train as you fight. You know, we got to practice it during the field exercises. You know, don't bring them then, so that when it's real, you're not bringing them by mistake or whatever. You know, get back and force the basics and, you know, understand that the threats are out there. It's something that's happening. It's not a threat that's going to happen. It's already currently happening.
Let's move on to the, you talked about the final frontier, the space domain. I think that is a very, A little known subject, just like many of the things that we're talking about here, is that technology and certain things are changing, you know, from day to day. And this is a little known aspect of the Army. But what can you tell us about that, the space domain, and how it applies to NCOs?
Sure. One way to look at space at almost the strategic level, but it equates to each individual soldier, space is the ultimate high ground. It allows us to communicate freely throughout the world, and a lot of our vital technologies like GPS is available because of the space domain. In fact, it was so important that a few years ago, we decided to dedicate an entire branch of the military service to space. But we can leverage those assets from the space domain to actually help in land warfare. For example, each like division will have, and maybe even push down to certain brigades, depending on the unit, will have capabilities and assets to leverage from the space domain. And it enhances our ability to effectively operate on the land domain.
I think something else when thinking about the space domain for NCOs is to understand that in a near peer, let's go environment, we're doing multi-domain operations. We believe that we will lose our space capabilities, which makes it even more important to do, like you mentioned earlier, and make sure you can drive both those Cadillacs. You need to understand how to do things digitally in case we win the space war. You need to understand how to do things in an analog way in case we don't. You know, our adversaries, it is no secret, all open source. China, in fact, has several satellites with robot arms or essentially attack capabilities where they think they can take out many of our satellites to help cripple our communication. And I'm sure we're thinking some very similar things. So, you know, for NCOs, train tactically analog and digitally. I think that's what the best thing you can do when you're thinking about space domain.
I think it was Sergeant Major Daly who reintroduced land nav to training. Was it Sergeant Major Daly or Sergeant Major Grinston?
I know Grinston for sure is when we got it reincorporated back into BLC. Yeah. It may have started with SMA Daly. Not 100% sure on that, but I know it is happening.
Yeah, I think that's an important discussion point, though, is that, you know, getting back to the basics, that being primarily one, because if GPS, back in the day, we used to have a Blue Force tracker, and that would tell everybody where everybody was. But, you know, if that goes down, then you still have to depend on land nav and your two Cadillacs to get you around.
All right. You know, you mentioned the Blue Force tracker. That is so interesting. There's another threat when you talk about deep fakes is hacking adversaries or even our own Blue Force tracker and turning units from friendly to enemy or putting things where things aren't. So you're essentially tricking the enemy into destroying themselves. That's something that is a threat and people should be aware of it and understand again how to do things analog. Like, I know you wrote something down.
Yes. Great point about being proficient in both digital and analog realms. And it's interesting, according to Russian doctrine, they actually prefer fighting in a degraded, i.e. a GPS degraded environment, because that gives them a distinct advantage over us. So that's actually nested very firmly in their doctrine, where they can be a little bit less precision fires, but it degrades our capability immensely because we rely on precision. They rely upon mass.
Yeah, I don't think they know we got land nav back in BLC, but yeah.
That's good.
That's definitely the way they think.
I think to add to that, a good example, because I was aviation, of course I have to bring it up. no, but the H-64 Delta had IR capability, but they also had a Blue Force tracker. So if they felt like their Blue Force tracker was down for whatever reason, if all of our soldiers just open up their little IR tabs that are on everybody's uniform that most soldiers don't even know what they're for, the Apache through IR can actually see all those soldiers on the ground. So I thought that's a good analog example of the same thing.
Yeah. Excellent point.
Do you have any other examples maybe for that, for an analog type of system like that?
I can tell you one of the things we're doing here at the Sergeant Major course, at least in the Department of Army Operations, we teach a couple of iterations of the military decision-making process. And recently we've incorporated how to use artificial intelligence within that process to enhance it, to get your products quicker, to make them cleaner, and stuff like that. But we realized that, hey, this is something they can't rely on. So we've run them through it at least two times where they're doing it once in an analog methodology with, like, here's a paper op order, and then once with the digital technology with, hey, here's AI, you know, here's some search engines, see what you can find, and let's produce some products. So at least that's just one example of where we're teaching it both ways in the NCO professional development system. And I'm sure there are others.
Let's move on to the cyber domain. I think a lot of these subjects kind of tied together in one way or another. Intelligence, you just brought up artificial intelligence tied to actual intelligence. Targeting analysis, contemporary AOE, transparent battle space. What can you talk about? I know that I'm kind of pulling a lot of things together, but I think a lot of this technology kind of relates to each other. You know, it's like they're tied together in one way or another.
Oh, sure. Domains are interesting. Multi-domain warfare is interesting to think about. When you think about the conflict continuum from peace to complete war, there's this spectrum in between, like conflict, armed conflicts, and, you know, so on and so forth. We are at different levels on that continuum in different domains. If you ask me, and this is just my opinion, is we are at war right now in the cyber domain with at least two to three of our adversaries. I think when you're looking in multi-domain operations, it's an important thing for NCOs to understand and consider is that you can have different levels of conflict in the different domains. Like, we might be at the cooperation domain in the land warfare, but at the same time, we're at full out war in cyber warfare, which is where I personally believe we're at with a few of our adversaries. There are many reports that have come out with the number of cyber attacks that come against the United States every day, and it's absolutely staggering. It's part of the reasons why we have to stay abreast of our training and, you know, keep our cyber awareness stuff up to date and pay attention to phishing attempts and all that kind of stuff. And it's important that NCOs understand that it's there and that they make sure their soldiers do their training. It's not just a check the block. It's there for a reason, because we are at war in these domains, and we do not want to give our soldiers we don't want to give our adversaries, rather, any advantage over us if we can avoid it. Did you have anything to add to that?
Just slightly, Dr. Nelson. It's good for soldiers to understand at possibly the strategic level, or at least operation level, that there's different methods our nation uses to address particular threats, whether for a healthy competition with, like, trade, corporations, international trade kind of drives the whole Earth organization, but then what additional things could our nation leverage, whether that's in the information space? We're mostly familiar with the military space, for example, but different threats can be addressed through different means or instruments of national power.
That's a great point.
Finally, let's talk about the ethics of attrition warfare. I found that part of the article the most interesting, and mainly because there's never any cut or dry, right or wrong. You know, it's like, it's, you know, when it comes to ethics, it depends on individuals, right? So how should NCOs prepare their soldiers mentally and emotionally for the realities of war in this kind of a technological environment that we're in right now?
That's tough. You know, it's definitely hard to prepare people for the death or the deaths of many of their peers, which we believe in a large-scale combat operation there will be lots of. I think the best thing from my perspective is to have those kind of conversations built into the training schedule, where you're having ethical conversations on what the right answers look like. Well, I think a lot of times the best approach, and this is just my opinion, is kind of the utilitarian view, where what's the good for the most people? And sometimes, you know, someone's going to have to probably sacrifice themselves for the larger unit, or maybe even be sacrificed if they have to attack a position that's heavily fortified or something like that for the rest of the unit. But I think you can start having these kind of conversations through scenarios early on to help soldiers start thinking about it. One of the things they could bring up, if they Google the trolley dilemma, that's a perfect utilitarian ethics discussion, where a trolley is going along and it's set to run over three people on the train tracks, but a person has the ability to shift it to make it change the tracks. And if they do so, it'll only run over one person. So the ethics come in. If I shift this, I am now responsible for this one person's death. If I do nothing, I'm not necessarily responsible. But other people could argue, if you don't do anything, those other three people are going to die. So it's your responsibility to have the lesser people die. And believe it or not, as simple as that sounds, that conversation can go back and forth and really help establish some good, firm utilitarian ethics in an organization. So I saw you wrote something down. Sorry,
yes, Dr. Nelson. Great question. We're going to have junior leaders making some tough decisions in the future. So how do we address that? They get more accustomed to it. Realistic, tough training, situational-based training. Also, what type of leader are they? Are they a leader, or is it likership? And that's difficult for less experienced junior NCOs to do. And even at, let's say, the platoon level, operating a casualty collection point, that's that young 68 whiskey attached to the unit there. They're going to have to make important and critical decisions of who gets treated, who has to be extended casualty care, and who gets evacuated first. In a LISCO environment, the golden hour, it's gone. It's obsolete. So how do you CAS-evac that casualty to higher level care, which is going to take time over space in a persistent battle space?
Yeah, I think the discussions are important too. I like that you mentioned the 68 whiskey thing, having some experience of that in my career. When you look at a training environment, if a soldier all of a sudden has a heart attack, the appropriate response is CPR. Until a higher level of healthcare can either get there, or you can evac the patient. In war, when that happens, that person's expectant, meaning they're going to die, and you're not necessarily expected to treat them because usually there's a whole lot of other people that are requiring your efforts. So I think good triage training is important for your medical personnel, but it's also important to just have the discussions to understand the other soldiers will understand that, you know, here's why this person's getting care, maybe these people aren't. You got to kind of prioritize your resources again to do the most good for the most people. So, yeah, it's kind of my thoughts on that.
I would hazard that this might be a good opportunity for some sergeant's time training. You know, having when I deployed on my second deployment to Iraq, I would have meetings with my guys, and we'd have guided discussions where we'd talk about the ROE, and then I'd come up with scenarios, and we'd talk about it. You know, and this would be a perfect opportunity for a discussion about this. You know, if this, then what? You know, what would? And then it's something that would include everyone. It's a conversation. Sometimes it would get heated, but as the NCO, it was my job to guide everybody back to the fold and get them talking about what it was that we were preparing for. What would you say, Sergeant Major Shealy, about Sergeant's time and how that can be used as a tool to get NCOs or their soldiers, for NCOs to get their soldiers prepared?
Absolutely. A very effective tool and method to utilize to do individual training. And it starts with either at the company or battalion level, actually planning the training and then also protecting it from other competing requirements. And I like to use the term ruthlessly protecting it, that nothing's steps on that dedicated training time that commanders have signed off on. It's vitally important for the junior leaders to understand that, so that time can be utilized effectively, but also protected. even look at syncing training schedules, for example. Instead of just expert infantry badge training, now it's EB3. Basically, all MOSs can get together to execute individual training, and that's usually done at the brigade level. So it's streamlining training management, but everyone's doing individual training at once, which is vitally important if you get a new influx of junior soldiers or preparing, you're kind of resetting to train up for an additional deployment. It's all protected time on that calendar that's dedicated for individual level training.
That's great. Yeah, I would say even beyond that, there will be white space that happens throughout the day, throughout the week, throughout the month. You either finish early, something's canceled, so on and so forth. An old term we used to use was hip pocket training. So, right, some of these ideas, you know, think about them ahead of time. And if you end up with an extra hour during the day, sit your squad down and have the discussion. You know, throw out some weird ethical scenarios and have it. Kind of get that ethical lens focused on what's really the best for the Army and for the units.
Sergeant Cox and I were having a conversation a while ago about the about attrition warfare, and he brought up the point that 3 out of 10 was acceptable losses to some degree. Don't you remember we had this conversation?
I believe somewhere in doctrine it states 30% rule.
Yeah, 30%.
Isn't that correct?
So, I mean, let's put that in real terms here. You know, you have a squad of 10 soldiers, and it would be acceptable to lose 3. To the American people, it's acceptable to lose none. And that's where that's decision making at every level. The commander has to make certain decisions, and then all the way down to the team level, you know, there might be a corporal having to make decisions at his level. As to what, you know, to execute the mission, these might be the losses. And that's where the ethics of attrition warfare comes up. At what point is anybody dying acceptable? I would say at no point, but it's a reality of war.
Oh, yeah. It's the nature of the job. And, you know, I would kind of add to that, and again, more of Nelson's opinion. I think the last time that we were truly at war was probably World War II. The entire country was behind that movement. They understood that people were going to die. Women took up jobs in the factories to help supply arms. We shifted our entire industrial strength to fighting that war effort. And there was nothing else going on. The wars that have happened since then, even during Iraq and Afghanistan, you could walk down the streets of New York and you would never know that we were at war. People were dying. It would get reported as numbers in the news, but they were always fairly low numbers. I think over 20 years, it was something like 5,000 and some, just over 5,000 soldiers, which is incredibly low, unacceptable, right? You don't want to lose any, but incredibly low when you think of war. I mean, you might lose that in a single battle in a large-scale combat operation. So I guess it's something that's hard to prepare for, but I'm not even sure that a population, not just the American population, but the population of the world, is willing to do that, especially with today's access to information and technology, and you know what's happening on the battlefront almost instantly. You see a battle where 20,000 soldiers die, that can decimate a population, and the morale at least, and it might affect their will to fight. So it's a challenge I don't have the answer for, but I think we need to know that it's there and to probably have some discussions ahead of time. That's how you've frequently thinking of something.
That's a tough one. And Dr. Nelson answered it very eloquently. I think it kind of boils down to getting a broad perspective here, the principle of war objective. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Is our society prepared to support those type of losses? And then how is that unit supposed to function if 1/3 of its population is a casualty, whether wounded or, you know, unfortunately killed in action? You know, that's going to degrade the capabilities, and how long can that unit have endurance to support continuous operations? Out of those 3, is it more likely leadership were injured or killed? And that's going to significantly degrade their combat capability, let alone how do you replace those key leaders that takes years to develop? at that level of proficiency. Well, tough, very tough.
I think it all comes back to what a recurring subject here is that, you know, you got to keep your soldiers trained with the basics. You know, and that's one of the things too with our series, the Muddy Boots articles that we publish, is that these senior NCOs, all the majority of them, talk about, you know, going back to the basics, learning, practicing the basics, and staying current with that, and then everything else will follow. So, anything else to contribute, gentlemen?
No. Hey, thanks again for having us on. It's always fun to chat about stuff that we either know about or have opinions about. you know, don't know everything, but I got an opinion about everything for sure. Yeah. They teach us that somewhere. But no, thanks. It's been fun. I know Sergeant Major Steele has enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. It was good. You know, Dr. Nelson and I, we both like reading about this, whether professionally or personally. It's a great way to have a conversation about stuff that we're interested in and have a passion for.
Yeah, and I'll throw a minor plug out. Myself and Sergeant Major Pingle have an article that's going to be published at the end of this month. Called Cognitive Warfare, Shaping the Soldier's Mind for Strategic Level Outcomes. Should be pretty good. I think it gets after some of the things we talk about in terms of the deep fakes and some of that stuff that goes online. So if that sounds interesting, hope you read it.
Great. We have one last thing, Sergeant Cox.
I did have a question before you went into the end. I just wanted to ask, Dr. Nelson, real quick first, is your book, is it secret in any way?
Can I
throw it out there? Okay.
Go for it.
Okay. Dr. Nelson, I just wanted to ask, because you're an avid writer for us, for the journal, you're getting ready to come out with a book. It's called NCO, A Primer. Can you talk a little bit about why writing is important? And not necessarily about the book, but just why our soldiers should read, should want to read, or should want to share their experience.
You know, one of my favorite things to say is, you know, still a quote from Mark Twain, where he said, "Those who do not read have no advantage over those who cannot." I think there's so much information out there that we owe it to our soldiers and our profession to know as much as we can about as many topics as we can. And reading is a very good way to get after that. I always like to say I'm not that smart, but I've read a lot. Some of it sticks with me, not everything. I'm sure I've misquoted something today, but I'm probably right on the majority of things that I've said. And I've got some informed opinions. It's important, I think, if you have an opinion, to have an informed opinion. And I think it's important to write some of that stuff down so when other people read it, they can learn from your experience. I like to tell my kids that you don't need to make all the mistakes yourself. You can learn from the mistakes of others. Read about it. Listen to what people say. Try to be better. Try to avoid making them same mistakes. I think that's the importance of reading and writing for the NCO Corps.
What would be a quick tip you'd have, Dr. Nelson, for starting something? And maybe a quick word to those who think maybe their experience isn't important enough to put on paper? That's a lot of the problem that we hear.
Great point. my experience myself is not that important to put on paper. So I guess the best advice I can give you is just start writing. Start journaling some things that have happened to you, good, bad, right or wrong. And you'll be surprised where that goes. When I was initially asked to write this book, I thought, okay, maybe I can stretch out 10,000 words if I look over the entire 30 years I spent in the Army and I think about everything that went well and didn't go well and shared some mistakes and stuff like that. Turns out, once you start writing, a lot of stuff comes back and a lot of stuff I found myself going, man, I wish I'd have known. I'm writing about something that I think, if I wish I'd have known about this 2 or 3 years earlier, I would have been better. Just start. And you'll be surprised how far it goes. I think the book ended up, at least my contributions, over 100,000 words. And I don't think I've had that interesting of a career. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that have done a lot more interesting things. So I would encourage you to just put pen to paper and see what happens.
Well, thank you, Dr. Nelson. Thank you, Sergeant Major Sheely.
Thanks for joining us, gentlemen. It was a pleasure and a very interesting conversation.
All right. Hey, thank you very much. Appreciate you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for joining us, and thank you to our audience. Remember to put your knowledge to the page, submit articles, and get published with the NCO Journal. Don't forget to check out our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll catch you next time on the NCO Journal podcast.